Today is Monday, the 3rd of December, International Day of People with a Disability. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, and we are dedicating the day to people celebrating disability and fighting for their choices and rights as disabled people. If you've tuned in to listen to Urban Voice, never fear, our regular programming will be back next week. But right now, I'm Ruby, and this is Rainbow Spectrum, a show about being autistic and LGBTI, and we're going to be talking about those parts of our identities. But first, I'd like to acknowledge that we are on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and pay my respects to elders past, present and future. I'd also like to pay my respects to any Indigenous people who might be listening to the program now. This country was never ceded, always was, always will be Aboriginal land. But today, I'm in the studio with two wonderful advocates for both the autistic and LGBTI communities, Ash and Melham. Thank you so much for being here with me.
Thank you very much, Ruby.
Thanks, Ruby.
So should we do some quick introductions? I'll kick it off because I'm closest to the mic. My name is Ruby, as mentioned before, or Ruby Susan Mountford. My pronouns are they, them. I'm the president of the Melbourne Bisexual Network and recently completed the Future Leaders Program with Autism Community Resource Centre and are currently helping advise an autistic organisation on being more inclusive for trans and gender diverse autistic children. Ash, do you want to go next?
Sure. I'm Ashley, and I've been advocating in these spaces for probably the better part of a decade. I've previously served on the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network of Australia and New Zealand, and currently am involved with Intertwine, which is a intersectional advocacy organisation. So that's me.
And hi, I'm Melham. I use they, them, their pronouns too. I've been involved with the bisexual community, transgender community, and I created and I lead facilitate an organisation called Spectrum Intersections, which is for the LGBTIQA plus neurodiverse community in Melbourne.
Yeah. Yes. Now, so the neurodiversity is something I've only learned about recently, but I only found out I was autistic quite recently, so about 2 years ago. So I was diagnosed at 26, which is significantly late as opposed to how people usually think of autism being diagnosed in children. But as I found out at my diagnosis, it was quite common for people who are assigned female at birth and raised as women. So for me, being diagnosed was quite a shock, and it kind of raised to me how much or how little of an understanding I actually had around autism and how much the presentations of what I'd seen had been very limiting and very lacking in diversity. And it was through that I also found out just how many autistic people are also identifying as LGBTI. So that's been an interesting area that I've become quite active in just trying to spread awareness for, because the LGBTI community isn't – we socialise at a lot of big parties, which aren't particularly autistic friendly. And so as far as identity has been going, so is that something that we've all had our own different pathways with diagnoses? But Ash, so what was your pathway to kind of discovering those parts of yourself?
So I was actually diagnosed as autistic when I was 26 as well.
Yes.
But for me, that was nearly 10 years ago. but I knew for a while before that I likely was autistic. So I had been involved in, I guess, the advocacy around neurodiversity prior to that. But access to diagnosis is actually a problem for a lot of people because it's not cheap.
It's so expensive.
Yeah, and I'm much more economically privileged than the average autistic and the average LGBTI person as well. So I was able to afford it, but for me it was nearly $2,000 out of pocket, and that was after getting what rebates I could, and that was with my psychs that were doing the diagnosis actually being creative and, you know, some of those sessions, like they did part of the diagnosis in regular, consultation sessions where I did get some rebate, and that's still how much it cost.
We're definitely going to be jumping into a lot more discussion around some of the issues that come up in the healthcare system for those two, like for the big intersections of autism spectrum and the rainbow spectrum. Because it's definitely something that's come up a lot when people have mentioned that they think they might be autistic and ask about getting diagnosed, because it always has to come up saying, how much money do you have and are you willing to spend over $1,000 on this?
Yeah, and some of the same issues can occur with I guess, identity surrounding some LGBTI identities as well. Mm. So I didn't actually know I was intersex until I was an adult either, even though it would have been clear to doctors. Mm. And doctors actually, like, pushed treatments when I was younger that they would only have known to push had they known about my intersex condition.
Yeah.
And it was never disclosed to me. So I found out when I went and saw an endocrinologist as an adult. So.
And so, Melon, what was your journey towards those parts of your identity that we've talked about?
Oh, well, not going too deep into it, but I didn't have a very supportive home life. So finding my sexuality and my gender identity was a journey I had to make my own. But that being said, I also was told I wasn't allowed to be disabled, which is quite an odd thing to hear from your family. So I got diagnosed with a lot of different things growing up, often in the mental health space. I didn't feel that any of those really fit. So, like you both, I was 29 when I found out that I was autistic. I also found out that I had Tourette syndrome as well. So I was like, what?
It's but a bit of a thing, isn't it? This whole sense of you've kind of been growing up and you've thought of yourself in the world as this one thing. And turns out there's a bunch of things that it can explain why you've been facing or running into these invisible walls the whole time.
And like, I mean, you know, for me, even just looking at taking control of my own mental health, I was unaware of that, you know, with certain ways that my brain thought, the ways that I retain information, that certain therapies that have been pushed on me for so long were never going to work. And so for me to even take control of my own recovery, I needed to understand myself and I need to understand what is in my control, what is not in my control, what can I change about myself and what do I want to celebrate about myself? And that's really important.
It is. It really, I suppose for me, my diagnosis was quite different. I didn't actually seek out an assessment. It kind of was being done over time by a medical psychologist I've been seeing for a long time for anxiety and depression. I was diagnosed with depression at 19 after having what I now understand to be autistic burnout. So basically where the cost of trying to, all the effort it takes to try and fit in and act normally becomes exhausting to the point of just complete burnout. And so it was through that that it was, she just said, have you thought you might have Asperger's? I was just like, no, no thanks, because my experience and exposure to autism was so limited. And then I was going online and reading a lot more about women with autism and people who were raised women in autism and camouflaging and masking. And I had just been diagnosed with ADHD. And so I was like, well, look, I didn't know, I hadn't suspected that. I didn't fit into what my brain had built around this idea of ADHD based on what I'd read and understood. So maybe I was wrong about that. Am I wrong about this too? And then I was reading all that information about how autism presented, and I was like, you know, just very intense and talks a lot and very sensitive. I was like, I mean, there's a lot more to that, just to be clear. If you've ticked those three boxes, that does not mean you're autistic. But it was very much a kind of a, oh, that explains so much of my life now.
Yeah, there's a lot of big issues around misdiagnosis. So it's common for autistics to be misdiagnosed with an assortment of mental health conditions when often they're either not there or it's a different mental health condition where the presentation is changed because you're autistic. So like an anxiety in autistics often looks different than anxiety in other people, for example. And especially for autistic women or largely anyone who's even perceived to be particularly feminine. So this can affect boys that are considered to be effeminate as well. And like it does happen irrespective of birth assignment. So that's while that's a fairly common framing that people will try and use, particularly in like non-binary and trans communities, it's actually a little bit misleading in a lot of ways because it comes down to the perception, and particularly with intersex people, that can actually that can be a big deal. So some people can be perceived as different genders at different times. And depending on that perception, that can lead into all these issues. And women in particular are much more likely to be diagnosed with emotional dysregulation, like bipolar, borderline, and sometimes even things like schizophrenia can be misdiagnosed. when it's actually autism. And yeah, you can be autistic and have those as well.
Yeah.
Like
you can be autistic and have other things.
That's right. But if you're diagnosed with the wrong thing, it means the treatment is wrong.
Yeah.
Mm. So like, you know, if you do have both of those things, you do need to know that. But if you're being treated for bipolar and you're not bipolar, the medication's likely to make you worse.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that matters.
It does. So we all identify as LGBT. We also, Ashley, you've got intersex variation. We've discussed it before. I have hyperandrogenism, which is sometimes considered to be an intersex variation. And
me too.
We've got a whole mix, wonderful bag up here. So, but I found that given that as I've been going into studies around the number of autistic people who identify as, you know, with a sexuality other than heterosexual and with a gender other than cisgendered, it does become an issue because that knowledge is obviously not really present in the LGBTIQA plus community. And as I was saying before, a lot of those spaces aren't really inclusive. So I've noticed that in a few places now, a lot of the parties are starting to try and have quiet spaces or trying to have like low sensory rooms, and a few of the conferences are starting to do those as well. But what would you like to see change in the LGBTIQA plus community to be more inclusive of autistic people?
I think, I think there's a couple of things that really come to mind. I mean, I personally, quiet spaces just make me feel that I have to go away and that I'm not included.
It's like a timeout kind of a thing.
And the worst part is I have Tourette's. I'm not quiet. I'm the furthest thing from quiet. Yeah, I've literally found myself hiding in toilets just to find quiet solace from events, and that's not really accessible.
Mm.
I guess, and the other thing for me is that I have a tendency to take things extremely literally. So if your party is for homosexuals and their friends, then I'm like, oh, I'm pan. Oh, I can't go. Yes. And I won't go to your party. And as much as, you know, people try and say, oh, well, we're being, in, you know, it's just an umbrella term.
Gay is an umbrella term now.
It can be really problematic for people who do look to see themselves. We need to know it's a safe space. And if your language is exclusionary, then we already know it's not a safe space.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And so on the flip side of that, so we've all had some experiences working or volunteering with or autism service providers. So how do you think they could be doing better to facilitate inclusion for autistic adults? Because a lot of these providing services do concentrate on parents of autistic children, but also for the LGBTIQA plus community, both as children and as adults?
I think that because so many of these services tend to centre the notion that autistics are children, and they also tend to direct a lot of their messaging to parents instead of to autistics ourselves, they are very reluctant to address the notion of sexuality in particular.
Mm.
To a lesser degree, they're reluctant to address the notion of gender identity and how those can interact with other, I guess, conditions and identities as well. And so they really need, because there is such a significant portion of the autistic community that is LGBTI, that has to actually be a primary concern.
Yeah.
So, you know, you get maybe, I think it's depending on how generous you are with the numbers, it could be 10 to 30% of the general population will be LGBTI. Whereas in autistics, it's probably somewhere between 30 and 50%.
I've seen as high as 70% as well.
Yes, though those are often surveys that have selection biases and that sort of thing. So it is possible that it's that high, but I would say it's unlikely.
Mm.
We obviously can't rule it out, though, because we do get surveys that sometimes do come back that high. Mm. And so if you're not talking about those things, it's quite likely that half of the people there aren't getting this information, or they feel in some way excluded.
Mm.
And children, when potentially half of the children even are going to be LGBTI, this is an educational thing that they need to be exposed to. Like, it's not, you know, it doesn't have the same arguments against it that it might do in the general population. And those are poor arguments, even applied to the general population. But at least there, people can turn around and say, give poor arguments like, oh, it's only one in 10 people that are gay, so why do we have to talk about it?
Mm.
But in autistics, it's probably as high as one in two. Yeah. So even that poor argument doesn't fly.
Yeah.
Like, we need to talk about this, and not just in adult contexts. Children need to know as well.
And their parents need to know, I think, that because if it's going to be a part of growing up, particularly for transgender diverse children, a family support is one of the key centres for ensuring, trying to improve mental health outcomes. So survey showed that about 40% of the children at the Royal Children's Hospital who are there in the gender clinic meet the criteria for being autistic.
Mm.
So 40%. And so surveys, I think, in that have shown that, 30% of the autistic community is trans, or that 30% of the trans community is autistic? It's one of those two.
It's there's some, again, it's the sort of thing where there could be selection bias, but we don't know how significant it is. So it could be that 30% of trans people are autistic. It's likely that it's a bit lower. Because autistics, I guess by our nature, because a lot of social conventions and norms aren't necessarily very intuitive to us because our social wiring's a bit different, we're much more likely to dismiss gender norms and not to absorb them uncritically.
Mm.
And so we're much more likely to be critical of gender and gender roles at a younger age. Mm. And so it might just be that autistics are much more likely to express gender diversity as children.
Yeah.
So, which also means that we need to make sure that places like the Royal Children's Hospital know a significant portion of their kids are probably autistic.
Absolutely. Now, we're going to be coming right back to this conversation. You've been listening to Rainbow Spectrums. This is part of our International Day People with Disability broadcast special. You're listening to 3CR in Melbourne. We'll be right back.
El Dorado, the story of Skouries, is the story of a fight of a small community in northern Greece against a multinational-owned gold mine project that threatens their homes and lives.
A grassroots movement is fighting against the destruction of the environment caused by the extraction methods and for democratic control over the most crucial basic resources, water, air and land.
It shows Greece in the era of social and economic crisis where the rights of communities and the environment collide with big business and profit. Come along to this free screening on Thursday the 6th of December at the Greek Centre, 168 Lonsdale Street, City. To book your free ticket, search Try Booking and El Dorado or go to the Greek Resistance Bulletin Facebook page.
A 3CR supporter.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Rainbow Spectrum on 3CR on the International Day of People with a Disability. Our theme today is choices and rights, and we're here talking about being autistic and LGBTI. My name's Ruby, and I'm here in the studio with Ashley and Melham. Thank you so much for being here again.
Thanks, Ruby.
Thanks, Ruby.
Now, we've just been chatting. We did an introduction about our own journeys towards getting a diagnosis of being autistic, which for all of us happened in our mid to late 20s. Now, we did touch on at the beginning when we were chatting earlier about health and healthcare, which is one of the key things that we really are here to talk to about today. And when we all began to talk about our experiences, we were all starting to pull faces and making the sounds of frustration that I think mean it's a good place to start with talking about therapeutic rupture. So therapeutic rupture is the sense of having enough negative experiences or basically developing distrust in therapeutic services and so going in and not being able to form therapeutic relationships because there is a sense of disconnect or distancing already, or at least that's been my experiencing of it. And I know I have issues with going to see GPs because of my experiences with that, but I really wanted to talk about all of our experiences and what could be done to make these things better. So what do you think? We've all had experiences with non-autistic people telling us that they know what's best for us in healthcare settings. And we mentioned before about how a lot of services are based on children. Is this something that's left over from having a child-set model or from this quite idea that is hopefully fading out that people with any kind of a disorder, as autism is still classified as, are really adults with the minds of children?
I found that I see that in a lot of autism spaces, they're still looking at therapies that are trying to change us, not necessarily in a helpful way. So I'm talking about ABA therapies, which were created by the same person who created conversion therapies.
And so what does ABA stand for?
Hold on, I wrote that down.
That's applied behavioural analysis.
Thank you very much. Winner over there. And so, I think that some of the biggest problems is that when it comes to autism and we're looking at children and we're looking at ways that we can support them, the idea is that there's something wrong with us and that we need to change who we are inherently as people in order to fit into society. And I think that that is a problem in itself because a lot of the things that they're asking us to change are not things that is wrong. There's nothing wrong with who we are.
And also we can't really change them. We can just hide them. And that's the thing as well. It's similar to conversion therapy is that, it's that sense of just hide those things and be ashamed, feel enough shame about them that you spend a lot of your energy in masking them.
Part of this comes down to the medicalization of autistic people tends to focus on how to, remove the autistic traits or how to avoid them. So you do see things like ABA, which has all the same negative consequences as conversion therapy does with, gay and bi people. Mm. And, the consequence of that is that the number of autistics that have ABA that later have PTSD is incredibly high with, estimates from 70 to 90%. Therapies like that actually cause damage, long-term damage that often cannot be fully repaired. Mm. PTSD is not a thing people just get over. It's usually a thing people have to learn to cope with. They don't ever get over it. Mm. And most of the autistic people I know will have some form of PTSD because they've been through a therapy like that, or they've been, in childhood, the way they've been treated by people has been in a lot of ways analogous to that, where they've been told, don't behave that way, that way that's natural for you.
Or the way that you're feeling is the wrong way to feel about this.
And that sort of gaslighting, is incredibly common. And that sort of attitude towards autism does carry over in the way doctors then treat adults. Mm. Sometimes people will conflate autism with intellectual disability. There are autistics who are intellectually disabled. But for them, that's an intersectional experience. They need their intellectual disability and their autism to be recognised as separate things, and they need supports for both of them. And when you reduce it to saying, oh, it's just autism, they don't get proper supports for intellectual disability, and autistics that aren't intellectually disabled get treated incorrectly.
Mm. This is also looking at the diagnostic, what you end up when you get a diagnosis. We get labelled. We get labelled a level. We used to get labelled functioning levels. But basically those always equated to IQ. And it's really not allowed people to know what our difficulties are because, IQ is not necessarily how we function in life. There are so many different aspects of the spectrum and how we are able to function, whether or not that's around sensory issues or cognitive issues, that it's not all down to IQ. And so by putting these labels on us like high functioning or low functioning or, level one, level two, level three, it's really removed us as people from our ability to get support for what we need.
And in a lot of cases, even when because those levels in the diagnostic criteria, there actually isn't one for autism. Mm. There are actually two ratings for support levels on two different axes. Mm. And yet people will still talk about people as having level one autism, but there is actually in the diagnostic criteria now, there's no such thing. Mm. There's autism with level one communication support or social support. Mm-hmm. That goes to those biases is that even when we've explicitly removed these from that diagnosis, parents and doctors are still doing this.
Mm. And I think as well, because of the stigma around the label that comes with being autistic, people who might be seeking gender reassignment surgery can be very reluctant to get any assessment because it can become an issue with having your doctors believe that you actually, you know, are wanting to transition gender as opposed to gender just being a special interest of yours because you're autistic and you're obsessed with gender. And then also I think, like, Ash, you also have to deal with the conflation that happens in the medical field with the confusion of transgender identities and intersex. So do you want to tell us about that particular circumstance we've talked about before? That's a whopper of a story.
Yeah, so because these things do get conflated medically, this is a problem for a lot of people. And it means that if a doctor is conflating those, you can often get the wrong treatment. So in my case, because I don't produce enough of the right hormones, I do need to supplement them. And because one of my prior GPs conflated intersex and trans, she was attempting to give me a treatment based on what trans women need, and it was wrong. And I told her that it was wrong and asked her to fix it, and she didn't believe me. It didn't get fixed until I went to another GP. And when my new GP, who is still my GP now, fixed those issues and the symptoms of like those hormonal problems went away, the symptoms of my colon cancer became visible, and we were able to identify that and treat it.
So the incorrect hormone therapy had been masking the symptoms of cancer.
Yeah, effectively. And so had I not realised that my doctor was treating me incorrectly and changed doctors, we never would have got to the point of identifying the symptoms of the colon cancer probably until it was much more severe. And
that could have ended really, really tragically.
Yeah, that could have ended with me not being here today to have this discussion.
Yeah.
So,
and I think that I've heard from you, Ash, and from you, Melam, about the fact that a lack of access to healthcare has been a bit, and also the issues of communication that we might have when it comes to talking about treatment and requesting treatment can have a really huge impact on our well-being and our life expectancy.
Oh, yes. Yeah, like I think that, like, even when we look at understanding of how our body mechanics work as autistic people, our bodies work differently. I'm highly sensitive to foods and I'm highly sensitive to medications, which means that oftentimes when I'm prescribed a medication at an adult dose, it's too high for me, which is unique in, like, the autistic community. Well, not unique in the autistic community, but, like, you know, in the human community. But the problem is that there are literally no studies done on medication specifically on autistic people, which is really, really hard. So if I, you know, I recently had a mental health crisis and I needed to go back on medication, but now that I understand myself better, I was able to put myself on a medication that was suited to me so that I wasn't overloaded with side effects, I wasn't over-medicated, I wasn't a complete mess. But that being said, going to see a different GP who didn't understand me then questioned my diagnoses, questioned my mental health condition because I wasn't taking a dose that he thought was appropriate for someone with my kind of condition. And I thought, who are you? You don't know me. I know me.
It's incredibly common that autistics have different reactions, in particular to psychoactive drugs. Some people do react differently to non-psychoactive drugs as well, but that happens in non-autistics, and I don't know if that's more common in autistics or not. But certainly autistics much, much, much more commonly react differently to any psychoactive drugs. And that means your antidepressants. So if you do have depression and you need that treated, you just might not respond to the drugs. We're the most likely to not respond to them.
And we're also quite likely to be depressed. So
anti-anxiety drugs as well. So I'm probably not totally insensitive to most of the anti-anxiety drugs, but I'm insensitive enough that I would probably need a dose that's not safe. So I can't take any of those that I'm aware of. And I have, like, sleep issues, and I'm effectively insensitive to all of the sleeping drug.
Yeah, there is a co-occurrence of insomnia with autism. I did a study at Olga Tennison Research Centre recently, and they said, "Surprise, you've got insomnia." I'm like, "Yes, surprise."
I had no idea.
But yeah, look, thinking about medication, like I know that statistically the highest instance of death in autistics is epilepsy, but there have been no conclusive studies on epileptic medications within autistic people. Mm. And that concerns me because, you know, there's been times I have taken epileptic medication and no one knows how it's going to affect my body.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like we're taking a guess. The whole medical community is taking a guess as to how these things are going to occur, which means that oftentimes we're having to self-advocate for ourselves a lot, which can be really hard in the medical community because, you know, we'd love to think that the doctors know what's best for us, but we don't always know if that's true. And that can be really concerning, which is going back to that rupture, that trauma that we're experiencing, because we literally don't know. We need to ensure that we're working together with those doctors.
And I found that in my case, at least, it meant that I am reluctant to go to a doctor often because I just don't – I know that there's going to be frustrations and miscommunications, and it's also difficult to find, in my experience, to find doctors who are – I can count on or not being homophobic, biphobic, transphobic or ableist, you know, because it's a big, like, huge area to cover, and it can be really difficult to find doctors who have a decent understanding of all of those different aspects of myself.
And yet, with respect to that rupture as well, so the life expectancy for autistics who do not have intellectual disabilities is 16 years less than the average, and for those that have an intellectual disability as well, it's closer to like 25 years less. So that like that intersection with epilepsy and that high. High morbidity that's associated with epilepsy mostly affects people who are also intellectually disabled because there's a big overlap. Though obviously there are people that fall outside that as well. Intellectually disabled people that do not have epilepsy and other autistics are still more likely to have epilepsy than the general population. In autistics that do not have intellectual disabilities, there is no single contributor to that low life expectancy that we can point to. There is no medical reason.
So there's no medical reason.
So it's basically what they would refer to as all causes mortality is people just don't live as long and there is no real reason we can point at to say why. It's almost certainly down to two things. One is suicide, because that's incredibly high amongst autistics, particularly LGBTI autistics, and that medical rupture, because if we're not seeking medical help soon enough, or we're not getting treated correctly, or if we get treated incorrectly, then we're more likely to die, basically. And that's why, you know, it tends to show up in that all causes statistic. And you find the same in other marginalized communities that don't have access to healthcare. So like you see that it's, you can't point at one specific thing that's killing Aboriginal people, but their all causes mortality is much higher because they don't have access to medical care, or they don't trust medical care.
All the medical care is often, you know, there's a lot of prevailing beliefs around our ability to understand our own levels of pain, for example, and believing our descriptions of our own symptoms. And I think these things carry across a lot of minority communities and marginalised communities when you have the kind of the doctor mindset of, we do know what's best and we think you're exaggerating, because often I think there's been an issue with doctors not really being told how to question their own subconscious biases. And I think that is changing, but it's not any, you know, it needs to change quite quickly in order to be effective for us.
I think, you know, some of these things, especially as an autistic person, some of my biggest issues is that I do struggle with my communication. I struggle to understand what doctors are saying to me, and I think doctors struggle to understand what I'm saying to them, because if I can't find the right word, I might use a different word, which changes a sentence, which changes its meaning, which means that I don't know if I have informed consent when I'm going to a doctor, which I think is really problematic. And we're not really discussing how we can have multiple forms of communication when we're going to a doctor, because there are times I'm like thinking, I just want to write down and tell you what I want to say, but I don't want you to dismiss it, because most of the times doctors really want you to just be a verbal communicator. And if that's not always what happens to you, because with me, I do go nonverbal on occasion, as a lot of autistic people do, it really puts a struggle on us, because people then question your capacity. And that's really difficult, because there shouldn't just be one way to communicate.
And we there isn't.
No.
We are going to be jumping right back into this, but I think we'll just take a short break now. Now, this has been some heavy stuff, but we are going to be talking about the good things too. So stay tuned for that. You're listening to 3CR Radio on the International Day of People with Disability. This is Rainbow Spectrum. We'll be right back.
In the summer, I went swimming. In the summer,
yay for summer. Summer brings swimming, summer brings picnics in the park, and summer brings the 3CR Summer Wine Fundraiser. Thanks to the support of Small Patch Wine Store in Hawthorne, we're selling 3CR Radical Radio labelled wines for only $15 a bottle. And they're even cheaper by the dozen or half dozen. Perfect as a gift or to fill a raised glass to toast 3CR at those summer festivities. Call the station between 9 to 5 on 9419 8377 to order, or go to 3cr.org.au/shop. Then you can drop into our Fitzroy studios to collect before the 21st of December. Small Patch Wine Store is a 3CR supporter.
You've tuned in to 3CR. This is International Day of People with a Disability, and we're doing a special 12-hour broadcast. You're listening to Rainbow Spectrum. My name is Ruby.
I'm Ashley.
And I'm Melam.
Hey. If you've just tuned in, we've been chatting for a little while about our experiences as autistic people who also are LGBTI. If you want to listen to the rest of that, you can grab the podcast, watch the space at 3cr.org.au and search for Disability Day 2018. Now, we've been talking a lot today about some of the obstacles and frustrations that can come with holding these parts of our identities. So being in autistic spaces that don't have an understanding of gay, lesbian, bi, trans, intersex, queer and asexual identities, and being in the LGBTI spaces where there's very little accessibility for autistic people. But I do also want to talk about the things that we all really celebrate about identities. I think that often our communities can fall into and feel like we're being defined by our suffering. And I personally wouldn't change a thing about myself when it comes to these overlaps. And I'd like to hear why it's like that for you too, please.
I think that how we think about the world and, like, you know, how we perceive it is such a fundamental part of our identity and our experience. You can't really take away being autistic and still be the same person.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, a lot of facets of the things that I enjoy and the things that I'm good at and even the things that I do professionally are probably a direct consequence of the way that I perceive and think about the world. So, like, you know, most people don't have the same sort of associative memory that I have, but I really enjoy doing, like, analysis and design of large, complicated systems. And if I didn't have, like, that large working memory and that associative, like, nature to my memory, I probably wouldn't be anywhere near as good at it as I am. And because it feels so intuitive to me, I really enjoy doing it.
Mm.
I don't need to use, like, abstractions the way other people do to think about a very large, complex system. And so I enjoy grabbing it and going, well, this little piece over here is going to interact with this little piece on right on the other side of the design because of these seven steps in between. And everyone else looks at me like, how can you possibly see that interaction? And I'm like, how can you possibly not? and you know, that's because of the way that my brain works and the way that I think about these things. If I didn't have that, then these things I enjoy wouldn't be as enjoyable. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, look, I'm really, I have a lot of sensitivities. So as much as I might, you know, let's not go into the bad, but the good thing is I have, like, the amazing sense of taste things that people are like, oh, this is really boring, are so overly flavorful to me. And I'm like, oh, yes. So I enjoy the most boring foods. People use the word boring around me a lot and I'm very confused because I'm like, this is amazing. What's that? I get to put tags on clothes for an entire day. Amazing. And that's just like, you know, how I am. I mean, you know, even if we think about intimacy, for me, intimacy on a sensual day, my God, autistics, the best sex. Best sex over here.
And yet we do have sex. I think we're going to get confused about that. And yeah, I think for me as well is that it's just the ability to, especially once you let go of the shame that often kind of gets pushed onto us, the ability just to care and to be really sensitive and in, you know, both in the way that we're sensory, so in my hearing, but also just in having in my emotional responses. Given that people always say that people who are autistic don't have empathy or lack empathy, the autistic people in my life are some of the most empathetic and caring, compassionate people I've ever met, and it made me feel a lot more proud of the depth of my ability to feel and to have compassion. And I think that also intersection with being bisexual, in that there's that kind of sense of being able to move through the world and have an understanding of just how much of society has given us ideals that are not, that have limited us and try to teach us to fit into particular boxes, but just how much they miss out on by trying to stay within them. And everything else that is outside those boxes is so bright and colourful, often maybe a bit too much so, but there's just so much variety and diversity as there is in every aspect of nature. And I think I would not give up being able to see those spaces for love or money. And they've become hugely important to me. And I think it's why I can do what I do. And I think it's why we all do what we do.
Yeah. Autistics, like generally speaking, have a lot more empathy than non-autistics. And there is that myth that we don't. And that's because
the ideal male brain.
Yeah, and that's because we tend to express our empathy in different ways.
Yeah.
And because other people don't necessarily perceive the way that we express it, they think we have less empathy. But actual studies have shown that we tend to have more. And we tend to have empathy that relates to things that aren't necessarily directly the same as us. So a lot of people have that in-group, out-group bias. It's like a really common psychological thing in the population.
Can you explain to me, sorry?
So that in-group, out-group bias is that people will feel empathy and will relate to people more that are more alike to them.
Yeah.
But autistics tend to not have that same bias. We're much more likely to empathize on specific traits or specific experiences or something like that. So and that's why a lot of autistics, like I will respond quite strongly to statistics. So if you tell me that, like, you know, 50% of people in this group are experiencing this problem, I'll be like, wow, that's a really bad problem, and I will empathize with that immediately. But a lot of people, they need to have that personal connection
and
to
a relatable connection where they can feel like they like, oh, well, I've experienced something like that, therefore I believe it's true because I felt it.
That's right. Yeah. So, like, I think that's one of the fantastic things about the autistic community is that autistics are so much more likely to empathize with people that are dissimilar to us, and so they end up actually being much more diverse. Because we're much less likely to push people that are different out.
And also I feel like we have a tendency to be really honest, oftentimes to our detriment. You know, people do not, you know, like to hear honesty. Oftentimes, you know, neurotypicals are very much avoidance of like, but I think it's really refreshing. Like, honesty for me is just, I want to know what's what, you know, I want to know what's what, but I don't understand your weird analogy. Just give it to me straight. Tell me what I want to know. That's it. And it's like when I ask someone, what's the time? And then they tell me it's 1:45. That's not the time. That's a math problem. That's not the time.
So, yes. And also, I love the other myth is that you can't have a sense of humour if you're autistic. Because that's what I saw on Wikipedia recently. So I was just like,
oh, yeah, tell that to Hannah Gadsby.
Right? I think that's it as well. I think, you know, there's still this idea in the autistic or non-autistic population that we'd want to be like them, and that that's the best way for us to be happy is to be more like them. And I think what is changing, as particularly as autistic communities are starting to grow more and people are starting to kind of reach out and find their peers through online spaces and everything, is that we're kind of getting a bigger sense of pride in all parts of ourselves, much like the LGBTI community has been working towards and works towards, is that saying, we don't actually want to be like you. We just want you to be okay with us being like us.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what a lot of this day is about, because people with disabilities, we don't want to be able-bodied people. We don't want to be exactly the same as everybody else. We want people to respect and understand our differences and that not see them as deficits all the time, and to look at what we can do well. For example, also, we wouldn't have Pokemon if it wasn't for autism, because the inventor of Pokemon is autistic.
Gotta catch him all.
As you can see, we managed to do those as well with our confounding factors. Thank you so much for listening. We've been Rainbow Spectrum here for International Day of People with a Disability. If you're tuning in expecting to hear Urban Voices, they will be back next week, so don't worry. And if you missed the beginning of the show, you can find the podcast at 3cr.org.au under Disability Day 2018. Up next is Brainwaves, talking about mental health and the NDIS. Stay tuned. I'm Ruby.
I'm Ashley.
And I'm Mellum.
Thanks for listening.